KBOO is currently running a Kickstarter campaign to build a city of media makers. From February 8th to March 9th, you can become a media maker and help spread the word. Just go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter between now and March 9th to join.
Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
When I think heaven, heaven in a black.
Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KBOO program all about books and the people who write them. I'm your host this week, Ken Jones. On today's show, our guest is Paul Cohn, author of the novel The Glam Shack. The Glam Shack is Paul's first novel and also the first publication from independent press 713 Books. The novel was nominated for a Pushcart Press Editor's Book Award and was included in the most anticipated small press books of 2017 list, from the literary website Big Other. Paul's short fiction has appeared in Tin House, Five Chapters, Hypertext, and 1111. He's won the Prairie Lights Prize for Fiction, received an honorable mention in the Glimmer Train Spring 2017 Fiction Open Contest, and was a finalist in a Black Warrior Review Fiction Contest. Paul's current project, a novel in progress called The Sleeping Indian, was named a finalist for the 2016 Big Moose Prize from Black Lawrence Press. His nonfiction has seen print in the New York Times Magazine, Details, The Village Voice, and Christian Science Monitor. James Salter writes of Paul's work, "There's a powerful, innate tension in his writing, which comes not only from his voice, but from his particular way of looking at things, an unusual way, and in art, in fiction, the only real worlds are likely to be the unusual." Paul Cohn, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you very much. Honored to be here.
Paul, The Glam Shack's not only your first novel, but the very first book published by the independent press, as we mentioned, 713 Books. We should also say that 713 Books has a Portland connection here. They recently published Portland author Alex Baer's collection of short fiction called Planet Grimm. But how did your book come to the attention of the folks there at 713?
Well, Leland Chuck, who founded 713, I had known him back in San Francisco when I lived there many years ago. And when he went to found this press, he came to me and said, I'd love to. He knew the story of what had happened with the Glam Shack, and it has a fairly complex history. And
is there a kind of a concise way to kind of give us a little bit of that history?
Or? Sure. So I had written a much earlier draft about 10 years ago. And I had given it to James Salter for an agent referral. Didn't hear anything back.
And James Salter was a professor of yours?
He had been a professor of mine at Iowa. Mm-hmm. And a few months later, I got a call from an agent in New York who said she just finished reading the book and was breathless. So I thought, okay, great.
Wow.
We're off to the races.
Yeah.
And we started shopping it around, and it ended up no one bought it. But a number of editors wanted to, one of whom was Josh Kendall, who's now an executive editor at Little Brown. He nominated it for this Pushcart Press Editor's Book Award, which is a bit of a consolation prize. It means the book you wanted most by that year but couldn't.
And that was for commercial reasons. The big presses turned it down.
Yeah. So I put it away and worked on other books. And then Leland came along and said, hey, I want to start this press. And Leland had gotten cancer. And he had had to have a complete bone marrow transplant.
Oh,
he was in the hospital for months. And they were waiting to see if this transplant would take. His whatever cell count that meant something was dropping and dropping and dropping, which was a bad thing. The day it hit bottom and started going up was July 13, 713.
Oh,
and
so July 7th, 2013, was that it? July 13th.
July.
Oh, what year was that then?
It was a couple of years ago, not too long ago.
But that clearly that's how he got the name of the press.
Yeah, and he thought, you know what? There are these strangers who have saved my life, doctors, the donor. I'm going to give back. And I'm going to create a press that does only debut fiction and brings the best debut fiction, I think, to the biggest light possible.
More based on quality than commercial potential.
Exactly.
And he picked your book. It was quite an honor, really, isn't it? He picked your book for the very first volume published by 713.
It was. It was an honor and a risk because, you know, there was no track record to go with, so we had to see. But it turned out wonderfully. For one thing, he's a brilliant editor. So we and brutal, which was what the book needed. So yeah, he really helped, so to speak, weaponize the book.
And so far, so good. Apparently, I checked the 713 website; they have a 2018 list already set. So they're a going concern.
They're doing great. I think they have gotten they seem to have gotten a lot of buzz about them, which is great. They did good work.
Now, Paul, let's get to your book then, particularly The Glam Shack. I should tell listeners it's about an obsessive love affair between the main character, his name's Henry Folsom, and a woman that you call only her or she, with the initial caps to the pronoun there.
Yeah.
And Henry is staying at the title location, which explains why the book is called The Glam Shack. It's a pool house in the woods owned by a friend of Henry's boss, so Henry's not loaded in the book.
The friend
of his boss is. And it's located around Silicon Valley, but you say in the woods about an hour south of San Francisco. And I read in a previous interview that you said the plot may be somewhat autobiographical, at least this starting point.
Sadly, yes. I would love to say, you know, that I wanted to experiment with telling a story where I cast the man in the stereotypical role of a female, in the sense that he's the other man, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But no, it came from experience, yes. And when I wrote the first draft, it really was day to day, just because writing made me feel better. And I wasn't planning where it was going.
Oh, it was just writing as therapy there? It wasn't, I'm going to sit down and write a story or a novel?
Well, no, I did want this to be a book, absolutely.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But I was letting the day-to-day writing dictate the next step.
Oh, you had no outline or
I did not have an outline. But that made my job, once I had a draft, to go back and climb on top of that foundation, and then is where I really started to construct a novel. And because it was such a voice-driven affair with the first draft, and I liken it to an unruly thoroughbred, which a friend of mine had a farm back when I was a kid, and they had retired thoroughbreds, and we would jump on them bareback, and they would take off with us every single time. Through the woods, whatever, have their way with us. And that was kind of like that first draft, terrifying and thrilling. And then my job was to somehow get this slick, quivering beast under control without neutralizing its power.
Well, that's a great metaphor there for the writing of the book.
Yeah, there's a lot of horse metaphors. I don't know where they came from, but yeah.
Well, maybe from your youth.
But that experience.
You said you grew up in Pennsylvania, in a kind of rural area there.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, in addition to your own experience, there are at least two other major influences on the novel. The first is Evan S. Connell's book called Son of the Morning Star, and that's about General Custer and the Little Big Horn, and includes the story of Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull in there. And all three of these historical figures play a part in the novel. Can you tell us why you melded some of this history into the novel?
I was reading Son of the Morning Star and Sophie's Choice while I was writing this first draft.
That was the other influence I wanted to get to, yeah. So let's talk about those two.
Yeah, and I've always been fascinated by Native American history. And when I was a kid, I would read every book in the library. But Son of the Morning Star is an absolutely gorgeous book. It is this, you see this coming cataclysm between Crazy Horse and Custer, and it follows them. It's just inspiring and beautifully written. And
I should tell listeners, Connell was also a great novelist too, Mr. and Mrs. Bridge and books like that.
Absolutely.
So quite a good storyteller.
Yeah. And at some point I realized that the story, this tragic story of what happened between Crazy Horse and Custer, had a parallel in the story I was writing. And in fact, if I were to somehow integrate that story, it would elevate mine. And I'm nothing if not ambitious. And I really wanted, at some point, and this was during the first draft, I realized I wanted this to be classical tragedy, meaning that things may not go as planned, but it upholds a greater truth. And I've always felt that about the story of the Sioux Wars of the 19th century, that there was some greater beautiful truth in this horrible tragedy. And I went ahead and linked the two, and we'll leave it to readers to say whether it works or not. Sophie's Choice, I would say, Styron did some things that I thought were amazing, and one of them was he would simply create a scene out of history between a very known Nazi leader, say, this is in World War II, mm-hmm. And someone else. He would start to talk about the history and then fade into a scene, and that scene is more real than, you know, most scenes I've read. And it just gave me the guts to try something like that on my own. I thought, well, if he can do it, I'll give it a try. And those two, Styron was kind of the fuel and Connell was the content.
Right.
Came together.
And Connell's book is actually name-checked in your book, in the Glam Shack. And Henry, like you as a kid, admires Native Americans, calling them almost an unadulterated people, or
the great unshackled.
Exactly, that was it. Uh-huh.
Yeah, he does, and he is looking for something to hang his story on that will lift it out of what he calls farce into something greater. He is overall looking for something greater than himself in this story. You know, it's like looking back to the old Greek myths, or, you know, some people read the Bible, some people, you want something that takes your story and makes it universal, and that's what he chose.
You're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. On today's show, we're talking with Paul Cohn, author of the novel The Glam Shack, published by 713 Books. In the novel, Henry's obsession combines the physical act of love, and I should tell listeners there's a lot of very sexual and erotic scenes in the book, but also combines it with his longing for the divine, which you mentioned, that word particularly in the book, and that sets up a dichotomy between the external, perhaps superficial world of fashion and glamour. Henry is a model, or later in the book, and works for this Glam Mag, this fashion magazine. And Henry's inner life in which he's seeking something beyond that, something heroic. And you called it in the book enchantment. In fact, there was one line in there where Henry wants to be something greater than himself. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that, external versus internal.
Sure.
Physical obsession and that kind of otherworldly enchantment, that ethereal almost.
Sure, absolutely.
Divine.
And yes, I do use that word several times in there. There is a dichotomy between his external world, which is defined by, you know, he lives in this borrowed pool house. He's involved with a woman who's engaged to marry another man. He keeps screwing up at his job with these interviews, and people get very angry with him.
That's a very funny part of the book, actually, how he does screw up.
Oh, my God. Over and over. And, you know, these things that maybe if he were real, and so to speak, you might shy away from the guy. But his internal world is almost the opposite. There's this deep sense of the richness of life and this craving to feel like he is part of something greater than himself, as you said. And the friction between that external Henry and that internal Henry, I find, is profoundly lifelike. And the external was not particularly likable, if you want to use that term, likable in fiction.
As you said, he might be somebody you'd want to avoid.
Exactly, exactly.
A screw up or...
He's caught in a vice of his own devising, and he's trying to find a way authentically out of it. And I think that authentic notion is important. And then you mentioned the physical,
which plays a huge part in the book, not only with her, his physical obsession, but later on there's the very beautiful, wealthy model you call the goddess in the book, and Henry has an affair with her as well.
I believe that Henry experiences the physical and the metaphysical as the same thing. That the physical is kind of the window into something bigger. And as a writer, what I really want to do is mimic music, in the sense that music is an art form that hits you on all levels, including the physical. And I would love for my work to be a kind of full body reading experience. And so the sex scenes are not necessarily even distinct sex scenes. It's just this river that flows, and it's powered by this sexual friction overall. And that in that intense physicality, I'm looking to go beyond the physical.
You know, I think you do that very successfully through the language of the book, which I should tell listeners is extremely lyrical. It reads almost like a poem, like maybe something out of Homer. The Odyssey, when you're talking about the tragedy and heroic, the language in there.
I'm going to put that reference in my back pocket.
Reads like Homer.
Yeah.
And in a previous interview, Paul, you said, and I quote, and this reflects perfectly on what we just talked about, another goal of mine was to create a kind of full-body literary experience for the reader in the way that music does for a listener, intellectual, emotional, and physical. How did you accomplish that? I mean, obviously the language in there, there's repetition of certain words, which I think is Homeric, or certainly like the wine dark sea. You use words like wumpsuck, sea belly, wonky, puddling. The plant agapanthus is used several times throughout, almost like a chant.
I love that, like a chant. I love that. I think the way, for me, the way to do that is to thrill myself with the music of the language. That when I really enjoy writing, it's when I get caught up in the music and the flow.
And there's a rhythm there.
Absolutely,
like music,
there's a
definitely
rhythm.
A rhythm with the language. I wonder, we have talked about this, about reading an excerpt, and I picked out a paragraph, and I think if you'd be kind enough to read it for us, it would give listeners kind of not just a sense of the that external versus internal that we talked about, kind of the physical and then the divine, but also the language in the book. And we have that early on in the book.
So this is, very early on. Henry has, the first time he meets her, he's in a cafe, she wanders by, she places a flower in a plastic cup on his table. She is also reading a scholarly book on the mind and motivation of a torturer. The second time they meet, they sit on a stone fence and dangle their feet, and he has brought along rousing prose, so to speak, to read to her to kind of paint a image of himself as a spirited dark horse. There it is, my God. He always has this notion of how he's being viewed and how he's going to package himself to someone else. And that is part of the box he's trying to get out of. So in this section, he is struck by her. He calls when she smiles, it's an event with a capital E. And he's musing, why is this? What is it about her particular brand of loveliness that turns old Henry to tapioca? She's not delicate featured, not in the least. She's got a big, strong jaw, hands that are almost manly, packaged cleavage and lioness hair. The hands remind Henry of his mother's no-nonsense, get-the-job-done hands. The jaw and cleavage and hair play superbly with the bearing, which is unhurried, regal, bemused. Her manner is this, you tickle me mildly. And this is what turns old Henry to tapioca. She seems to need enchanted moments as much as he does. What's more, she seems to see enchantment in him, which makes old Henry feel downright lovely, even divine.
Oh, that's beautiful. Thanks for reading that. And that gets in his physical attraction to her, but also his desire for the divine, for enchantment, something beyond the physical.
Something
greater.
That was an excellent choice. Yeah, it brings the two together.
Now, the book itself is structured very in an interesting way. It's a series of short chapters, and each chapter is titled with a date. And the novel's present is in the chapters dated August 1999. So this is in Silicon Valley just before the dot-com bust and before the Y2K fiasco and all that, or actually the lack of a fiasco. And then the recent and distant past. What happens in the story described in chapters dated February through July 1999, and even a few go back to 1976 when Henry was 10 years old. I was wondering, what were your reasons for organizing the book like this?
Well, the premise of the book is, it starts, she was dictated by the events. She leaves, says, I got to go back to visit my fiance for 12 days to make my decision between him and you. And Henry's left there in the glam shack. And he's got to figure out something. So what he does is, and by the way, the first title of the book was, the working title was 12 Days. What he does is relive the affair in the hopes of escaping it, of trying to convince himself that she is such an unworthy person for him that then he won't be in love with her anymore.
Anticipating that it might not be a good result when she goes back to the fiancé, that she won't return to Henry?
Correct. Or that, hey, your woman just went to be with another man and you're putting up with it. This is not a good thing, Henry. But things don't go as planned for Henry. So that structure of looking back was built in from the beginning. But then after each passage or scene where he's looking back, reliving their affair, it comes back to the present. And those present, if you talk about rhythm and pacing. Those Glam Shack present current time chapters are very important for the pacing, I think. It's where a reader can breathe. And
because it's more of reflection on events, where the events are happening in the other chapters.
Absolutely, yes. Uh-huh. It's a reflection. It's a pause. And because the writing is so, as you said, lyrical, because it goes for that musical intensity, reader needs a pause now and again, mm-hmm. just on the level of rhythm and pace. But then again, it does a content job as well, which is it makes sense of what happened before and sets up what's about to happen. And after a while, you realize that Henry's intention, which is to fall out of love, and he keeps bringing it back up in the Glam Shack chapters, comes butting up against the actuality of this deepening love. And then what's he going to do?
And I should mention, too, that these August 1999 chapters are written in the first person from Henry's point of view. The other chapters are third person. So that must have been a conscious decision where the events happen in the third person and the reflection happens in the first. Was that what you were getting at with the different perspectives?
Yes. It seems psychologically true to me that Henry would relive it in the third person because he wanted that distance mm-hmm. from himself. And he needed to view himself as someone else in a way in order to get a handle on, get control of it, of events and his own intentions. And also that third person just gave me as a writer more license to really indulge my love of language. First person is different, and it's almost a straitjacket, and which I donned, you know, gratefully in those very short current time chapters.
Right,
but I was happy to throw it off.
Well, Paul, I wish we had more time, but this went very quickly. I just love the book, and I'm really glad that publishers like 713 are around to bring this to us as readers.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I'm honored to be here, as I said.
We've been talking with Paul Cohn, author of the novel The Glam Shack, published by 713 Books. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to Paul for visiting us at KBOO. And to all of you for listening.
KBOO Radio trains media makers. We believe community resilience happens when citizens learn how to make their own media. For the last 50 years, KBOO has trained thousands of citizen journalists to report on what goes on in the streets of Portland and far beyond. We know that with our expertise and your support, we can keep this city activated and aware through radio. Invest in Portland's future media makers and join KBOO on Kickstarter today. Look us up. Search for Help KBOO Build a City of Media Makers. And thank you for your support of KBOO.
Welcome to the film show on KBOO. I'm S.W. Konser, and today we're bringing you previews of two long-running film festivals getting underway here in Portland. Our good friend Ben Popp is in the studio.
Hey there, Conch.
Ben is the programmer for the Northwest Film Center. Your official title is?
The Filmmaker Services Manager.
All right. And he'll be telling us all about the 41st Annual Portland International Film Festival, PIF 41. And we've also got Rana Neuenschwander on the line. She is the coordinator for the, she is one of the coordinators, sorry, for the Cascade Festival of African Films, along with Tracy Francis. And just to make things really interesting, we're also joined by three local filmmakers, Dawn Jones Redstone, Greg Hamilton, and Ira Flowers. Their short films will be playing at PIF as part of the Made in Oregon program. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
Hi, I want to make sure that our listeners get a chance to hear all about the upcoming screenings of your new films. But first, I believe we do have Rana Neuschwander on the line. And let's see, Rana, I believe you're all picking up some filmmakers right now to come into town for the Cascade Festival of African Films. Okay.
That is all right.
Oh, fantastic. Okay. In fact, I believe your colleague Tracy is at the airport right now. Who's coming into town?
So tonight we have Dr. Bassem Youssef, known as the John Stewart of Egypt.
Okay.
And he's one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people. And so he will be here to influence us with a documentary about none other than himself tonight at PCC Cascade Campus at 7 o'clock. So he's flying in as we speak.
Now, this is a fellow who's come under some pressure from the regime or from the establishment there in Egypt?
Yes, he has. He no longer lives in Egypt because of the pressure put on him.
That's the power of comedy right there. well, the festival is already underway, but there are several more weeks of events still ahead?
That's right. We have... up until March 3rd, so we have 4 weeks here still in the festival every Thursday, Friday, and Saturday evening, and then afternoon matinees on Saturday, and Thursday we have matinees also. So we have many films from every corner of Africa that we're showing, all free of charge, open to the public here at PCC Cascade, and a centerpiece film at Hollywood Theater on the 16th, next week, Friday the 16th.
Okay.
Hollywood.
Well, the events are free, but I understand you're always happy to accept support from the community?
Always happy. We have wonderful supporters that come back every year, but we also take donations at the door or anytime through our website. Yes, we enjoy